Learn to code, build apps, inspire the next generation.
Welcome to the Swift App School podcast, where we are empowering the next generation of app developers.
I'm Charles Long, co-founder of Swift App School.
And I'm Bob Williams, co-founder of Swift App School.
All right, welcome to Season 2, Episode 3 of the Swift App School podcast. Today we're going to discuss Computer Science Education Week, Swift App School's App Camp in June of 2023, Swift App School and Mac Stadium's partnership and the case study that they did on us, and what's next for Swift App School, and then some really cool stuff that Apple's doing at the end. So, how you doing, Charles?
Great. It's been a long time. Yes, it's been a long time. So much has happened since June, and no, we didn't give up on the podcast.
We've been wanting to have a podcast for a while, but just finally worked it in.
Yeah, my work schedule was insane after App Camp. July was pretty insane. I had some massive projects to take care of on my day job, which was pretty intense. And thankfully, that phase of my job is over and I can move on to getting things back to normal. And so those projects were great. I learned a lot from them. And yeah, I'm hoping to be able to be more involved in Swift App School and some other exciting adventures.
Yeah, who knows what's ahead for us.
First, we're going to talk about Computer Science Education Week, which wrapped up today, actually, December 4th through December 10th. We're recording on December 10th for 2023. Those were the dates. And for those who don't know what Computer Science Education Week is, it's an annual call to action to inspire K through 12 students to learn computer science, advocate for equity, and celebrate the contributions of students, teachers, and partners to the field. And one of the biggest players is code.org. They've done a lot of work in this area to try to bring computer science to the forefront across the country. As we talked about in past episodes, computer science is something that really needs to be taught in all of education, K through 12, not just in college. And we're seeing a great increase in the number of schools that are adopting this curriculum, which is great to see. But there's a lot of work to be done, obviously, with the future of AI, something we've talked about forever, one of my hobby horses. Yep. So we're just trying to do our tiny part to help bring this knowledge forward. I think we say it a lot. I feel like coding and computer science is going to be synonymous to reading and writing in the future. I think now more people are becoming aware of it with ChatGPT and Bard and all those other AIs out there that are making people recognize, oh, this is the real thing.
Yeah, you know, we started this back in 2015. So the fact that when we were doing it then, think about the students who are coming to App Camp now versus when we first started having students come in. Most had never really had any coding experience before, except for maybe a few. Now it seems like it's almost half and half. It's like some that haven't, but a lot that have, and a lot that are interested. And then we're also seeing like more 8-year-olds and younger students who are interested in coding and interested in doing more than just Scratch. So I think that's a positive as well. But yeah, there definitely needs to be more in the school system. And I'm glad to see some school systems, you know, starting to do more. And hopefully we'll be involved in that as well.
Right. I noticed on some of the websites that North Carolina isn't as active, and maybe that's an opportunity for us. That would be great. As you look at the map, where especially code.org will have the United States and they have the percentages of high schools that are teaching computer science, offering courses, which governors or businesses in those areas are promoting it. We got a lot of work to do. So,
oh yeah,
I'm excited to be able to be a part of that. It's not just us trying to take over the world. There's a lot of people that need to get involved, businesses, nonprofits, teachers, and
more teacher training as well.
Right. I think we're playing catch up in the United States. So I hope people understand how important it is. And I know that pretty soon on my day job, since I work in education, there's an AI discussion coming up within the next week. So it'll be interesting to sit in on that session and see what their mindset is, what get people's feedback that are in the faculty.
Okay, now we did mention App Camp. That was back in June. Can you believe that? Way back in June.
Yeah, I feel bad we haven't had a podcast.
Only like 5 months later that we're talking about it. But yeah, so that took place June the 26th through the 30th. We had a number of students, mostly new attending, some returning. We had about 16 students, ages 12 to 17 or 18. And the projects that we did kind of a basic app like we always do. I did something with movies that I think they enjoyed. We kind of talked about Lisp and taught them Xcode, just the basics. Taught them about Swift UI, VStax, HStax, other syntax that was new to them, and just how to use the Xcode tools that a lot of them were not familiar with. We also introduced them to augmented reality and just really let them play around with the reality kit and make their own types of games. So we started off with just a simple bowling game that we showed them, and they had fun with the assets and created lots of creative things. So it was kind of neat to just let them, you know, play around with that and see what they could come up with. And then, you know, you can talk about Robbie's game, but Robbie, one of our students, who's now a teacher, created a game. We call it Swift Dash, Geometry Dash Clone, and a sprite kit game, and it was impressive. I think the students really enjoyed it.
Yes, I'm always amazed when we have students that have been TAs for a couple of years, and we ask them to bring forth that final project. It's amazing to watch their, you know, their progress from the point they started until now. And Robbie's a great example of a student who not only was excited about learning coding coming in with a little bit of experience before, but just really diving in his spare time to learn a lot more. And it showed up, you know, when we asked him, hey, can you make a geometry dash clone? And didn't take him very long, honestly. And some of the challenges he had to face in order to make that game, it's like, this is pretty amazing to sit back and watch. I feel like we're just kind of ushering in these tools and some basic training and try to mentor. And then after that, they kind of take off with it. And, you know, these are commercial games that we ask them to try to mimic or replicate. And within a few days, they can do it.
Yeah, didn't he have to learn like trigonometry that he hadn't even had in high school yet?
Something like that. I think for some of the past projects, he did.
Yeah,
that's right. I think that's awesome because it shows that we're not just teaching people how to do Swift. There's so many skills that you're building up when you're learning how to build apps through our courses or through our app camps. And especially if you become a TA, you get a lot more opportunities to showcase that. So that's amazing to watch. I get more excited about that than anything else, that we can see the progression from started coding, playing around with code, now writing apps and games, and you're not even out of high school yet. That's amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah, and I mean, it's nice because at the end, we kind of do a survey with all the students just to, you know, and let them be honest. And, you know, we've gotten 5-star reviews every year, which is great to hear. One of the students, I just wrote down one thing that one of the students said, you know, they like the style of teaching, the hands-on activities and visual examples. It says, I liked how they taught that it's okay to make mistakes and that fixing them are rewarding. I really like that because, you know, that's the thing we try to point out is that, hey, you don't have to have all the answers. You know, we don't know all the answers going in. And a lot of times we have to look up the answers because we're, you know, I mean, we don't memorize the stuff. So it kind of, it helps them realize, oh, okay, I don't have to know everything. I can, you know, learn as I go. And then if I forget, I can go back and look it up again, which is what most people do, you know,
right. Yep.
Until you've done it a million times. So yeah, so it's just kind of nice. And then they also gave great reviews for our TAs. And if they had any problems, the TAs were right there to help along with the teachers. So it's just good to have that feedback and to know that, you know, we didn't leave anybody behind.
I think there's a lot of fear of failure. So this is a problem with coding that people get intimidated when they first come into like trying to figure it out, and they get on YouTube maybe and they find, you know, 100 different instructors and they're trying to figure out where do I start, and when they have a problem and they get stuck and they don't have that mentorship to help them at that moment. And so they get discouraged. And coming into the app camp, they have an opportunity to see that, no, we go through the same exact things that these students do. And it's a way of life when you're a coder. You just expect failure. And it's when you have the aha moment, like that's what makes everything worth it. It's so rewarding. And when we see them have those moments, it's like it resonates with us. All of us are excited together.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's also nice to just see the teacher assistants that are helping out. Just they have aha moments when they're helping somebody else. Yep. 'Cause, you know, the best way to learn is to teach, as yep. we always say. So that's always nice too.
The next topic I want to talk about is the Mac Stadium case study. So Mac Stadium is a company that provides cloud resources for Apple platforms. So they provide hardware for continuous integration, and they provide developer tools so that if you have, let's say, a company and you want to have X amount of Apple computers, you don't want to purchase them, you just need them for a short amount of time, you can reach out to Mac Stadium and you can purchase, you know, maybe for 1 year, I need 50 machines and I need to be able to test my app, or I need to test some type of Apple workflow, whether it's an app or if it's just I'm testing on Apple hardware or need the hardware for my employees, whatever. You can rent / lease machines, however you want to slice that. But basically, it's kind of like a scale up, scale down sort of thing. From year to year, you can adjust the number of machines you purchase. And obviously, we use their platform for our lab environments because we didn't want to have that disparity between students, where some students have a Chromebook, some people have PCs, some have Macs, some have different types of computers, some have older or some have newer. We wanted that consistent platform. So obviously, Mac Stadium is one of the options out there, in our opinion, the best option because of their Orca Workspace platform. We've been working closely with Mac Stadium and their engineers and their team on their roadmap, which has been exciting for us to have that relationship. We can give them feedback. That's been great for us. And in doing so, they tailor their solution more for education. And yep. it's sort of a win-win situation. And out of that, they said, hey, if you help us, we'll help you get the word out about what you're doing and giving back to students. It's a great win for them because they can show how they're also giving back in the sense that, you know, their platform is sufficient to provide a platform yep. for education. So that's why we use their Orca Workspace. It allows for browser-based cloud access to an Apple desktop, so you don't have to have an expensive Mac. You have a fully up-to-date Mac device running the latest operating systems, and that's pretty cool.
As soon as you log in, you've got Xcode. You don't have to worry about installing it. You don't get overwhelmed with the install process. It's already there for you, and so that's part of the appeal is that it makes it even easier for students to get started online, and we don't have to be there to hold their hand because it's already up and running as soon as they log in.
Yeah. The great thing is, you know, after teaching our class to the students in Ecuador, we were able to talk about that experience with Mac Stadium. This is why they wrote a case study on what we're doing, and we'll provide the link in the show notes, but the topic is teaching the next generation of iOS developers. Swift App School and Mac Stadium join forces to deliver app development education globally. So it's really cool. I'm not going to read through all of this, but it basically talks about how we provide our curriculum to these students. And it doesn't matter where you are, as long as you have a web browser, you can access these tools and resources using their platform. And that's exciting. I'm looking forward to what else we can accomplish together with Mac Stadium.
Yeah, to anybody listening, we're going to do more of this in the future, the online classes. So if you're interested in signing up for that or interested in learning more about our platform, don't hesitate to reach out. We'd love to talk to you about it. Well, let's move into what's next for Swift App School. We've got more partnerships with some nonprofits to broaden our reach. That's something that we're working on now. We're actually talking to some local nonprofits at the moment. We'll be reaching out to them and to their students. We also are wanting to focus on a younger audience, and some of our TAs have an opportunity to be teachers and to teach not necessarily app development, but Swift UI and some playground examples and samples to younger audiences like ages 8 to 12. So I think that's a really nice new audience for us to focus on. And we're really excited about that because, you know, it just gives these students something besides Scratch. You know, it allows them to learn Swift at an earlier age. And Apple has some of this on their website, but, you know, that there's no one there teaching the students. And so that's what we feel like we will fill the gap in teaching and kind of helping them get started, because it's very overwhelming when you try to get started, especially as an 8-year-old, and the parents aren't really going to be able to help. So that's what we're here for.
Right. And we saw this as an opportunity because we had gone to conferences, and one of the questions that repeatedly came up is, well, my student's done with Scratch, now what? And obviously we have some local organizations that could help a little bit with that, but they don't have curriculum and they would rather have someone who's educated in the field to help them out. And so that's kind of how this was born, in that need to reach that younger audience. And we kept hearing it over and over, like, oh, your camp is for 13-year-olds and up. My child's really into Roblox, Minecraft, and other things. What other creative tools are there out there for my child? And we hate to tell them Scratch, because most of the time they've already been through it. They've blown through that. Now there's nothing. And like you said, they're so much more advanced these days because of the tools and games that allow you to create things at a younger age. They're already ready and yearning for more. Like, they're hungry to do something else. And so with that said, I think we're going to have to adjust our curriculum to match. Like, if we start seeing that 75% or more of our students are coming in with programming, coding experience, then that's good for us. But it also means we have to change the way we teach. And I expect that to happen. Like, it used to be 9 out of 10 people had never written any code, but it's not that way anymore. I think you mentioned, like, maybe half have done some form of programming before. So that's good. But we like to help those students, and app development is probably too advanced. It's just a little overwhelming to try to learn the entire Xcode interface. With this audience, we can focus more on Swift playgrounds, whether you have an iPad, or use our online platform to create some basic Swift playground projects. And so at this moment, we're calling it Playing with Swift. And that's just a very basic curriculum over a set of weeks that you can practice. And hopefully we build up that curriculum as well. So we're going to see how that's going to unfold from here forward.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Okay, let's talk about Apple's 2023 event announcements.
It's a lot of
normally,
them.
normally after an event, we have kind of a briefing. Yeah. And I know the last one we did was after WWDC, and there was two events that happened. One is the September Wonderlust event, where they announced the iPhones and the Apple Watches. And the next one was the Scary Fast event. So I'm going to run through some of the announcements, and we'll just kind of jump back and forth on our thoughts about this. I'm going to talk about the iPhone 15 and the 15 Plus first. And this is not the Pro or the Pro Max, so it's just the iPhone 15 and the iPhone 15 Plus, the larger size. Essentially, what they did is they announced the iPhone 15, which is their kind of base model, and the larger size as a upgrade. But essentially, what I noticed from reading through the, watching the keynotes and reading through the notes that were sent up after the fact, is essentially an iPhone 14 Pro. So if you were to take the iPhone 14 Pro, all the guts, and stick it into the iPhone 15, then that's pretty much what you can expect. Everything except for the always-on display. So the A16 was the chip from the iPhone 14 Pro. That's the chip that's in the iPhone 15s. Very smart move by Apple to save and conserve a very powerful chip. some people have their opinion about Apple doing this, but I don't have a problem with it because I feel like their chips are so powerful. Why toss out the iPhone 14 Pro chip after 1 year? Like, they're basically just kind of passing down the features that they created the year before to the base models.
And those also have the roadside assistance as well, right?
Right.
The 15, as long as, it's the same as the 14 Pro has.
Well, the 14 Pro had satellite, but this is actually, so they have a roadside assistance service.
Oh, okay.
That's actually a new thing for all the 15s and the 15 Pros. Wow.
So they're putting some other businesses out of business, I guess.
I wonder. Eventually. I'm not, well, maybe. I know that the roadside assistance, they partnered with, I'm assuming, like AAA and mm-hmm. other places. But somebody probably was doing this before and and connecting people with those services. I don't know. I don't really know that market. But if you're on the side of the road and you have satellite access, I mean, this seems like a perfect fit. Like, if you have satellite and if you can make an emergency call and that's it, I guess, I mean, that's good. But maybe you didn't need an ambulance. Maybe you just need roadside assistance. Mm-hmm. So seems like the perfect next step for Apple to provide that. And I think that...
Well, it fits in with the crash detection as well. It kind of like fits well with that.
Right.
Which they already had.
It makes me wonder. I know that they have these satellites. I'm not exactly sure of their capabilities. But a part of my subconscious says, I wonder if Apple eventually is going to use this satellite service as their own provider, you know, as their own data and voice.
I thought you were going to say it makes you wonder if they're going to have the car soon.
Oh, no. I don't need an Apple car.
What would it look like anyway?
I don't know.
It's a big iPhone?
Yeah, possibly. A lot of meme jokes come out of Apple car. Yeah. In order to charge it, you're going to have a proprietary adapter. Yeah. That's what a lot of the memes I hear. But I will say, the iPhone 15, finally, I think because of some pressure, the iPhone 15 has USB-C charging. Uh-huh. So, you know, Apple tends to say they're in control of everything and they were planning to do this anyway. But I do know there's a lot of pressure from the EU.
Yeah.
Across the board. They wanted all phone providers and device makers to use USB-C. It was pretty apparent they were pointing a finger at Apple because they have that Lightning connector on their devices. And some people were complaining that, oh, they changed it again. But my thought is, well, everybody in the world is using USB-C now as the connection of choice. I knew it was a matter of time. I know that they probably would have dragged it out longer had not the EU got involved and basically, we're saying, what was it, 2024, 2025, they wanted all phones USB-C. Mm-hmm. So Apple didn't wait for them to bring down that judgment in court and make it official. They just decided, hey, the iPhone 15 is USB-C. Yeah. And so I'm glad. I mean, it does make it inconvenient if you have adopted Lightning everywhere. So like cars, my cars, I'm realizing now I need to figure out a way to plug my charger that has the, you know, the FM transmitter, I should say, that's Lightning.
Yeah.
So I can't use that to charge my phone while I'm driving anymore. So I got to think about some things. Mm. Like my family doesn't have USB-C because they don't have iPhone 15s yet. So we can't exchange cables. So there's a lot of things that have to transfer over.
With my iPad mini, because it's USB-C, I had to buy a couple of extra cords just because I kept losing them. I only had one cord that really worked for charging. So, yeah.
The other thing they added was ultra wideband chip. So this allows you to basically have a better experience when you're trying to find your phone. Mm. And it also helps, let's say if you and your family all have iPhone 15s or above and they send you their location, you can find them just like you can the AirTag. Mm-hmm. So it's very precise. You get that same interface where the arrow is pointing towards their direction. Mm-hmm. Like that chip allows that. So it's much more precise. So that's great. I'm glad they have that feature added to their devices. I kind of figured that was coming at some point, that you could find people just as easily as you can find your AirTags.
Yeah.
I'm sure Tile is loving this right now. But those are kind of the big announcements for the iPhone 15 itself. Oh, I forgot. So the dynamic island, that was a feature added to the iPhone 14 Pro. That also came over to the standard iPhone 15 phones as well. So that's kind of just the iPhone 15. The iPhone 15 Pro and Pro Max, the big news for those devices, the new titanium design, which makes it much stronger, but it's a lighter metal. So the phone feels lighter. I don't really recognize it. And of course, I had to get the new phone.
And it's a really hot phone, too, as I've heard.
I think at times I felt like it's gotten warmer.
Does it overheat sometimes?
Mine doesn't, but I've heard some complaints about that. Yeah. Maybe I just had the best of luck with Apple devices, because sometimes I hear reports and I'm like, okay, let me watch out for that. Mm-hmm. And I don't really have those experiences, but I kind of use my phone as a phone. I'm not playing games on it. I may watch YouTube videos on it or something like that, but I'm not really using it as heavy as other people are. And I have a clear case on it, so I don't know if the type of case matters as far as heat consumption. I don't know, but that's the interesting thing about a titanium phone. Unless you buy a clear case, you don't even notice it. Mm-hmm. Like the last three phones, I get the color I want, but at the same time, even with a clear case, it's not the same. Like, I don't think about the color as much anymore because I don't carry it without the case.
Same.
So, let's see. A17 Pro is the chip. Now, the most important part of this particular phone is the 3-nanometer chip. For people who follow chip technology, for the most part, this includes all computers, have been running on 9 and 7 nanometers. And recently 5 nanometers, and 5 is pretty amazing. Apple was one of the first companies to run a 5-nanometer chip. And in English, that basically means like how far apart are the circuits on the chip. Like the smaller the number, the more they're packing it in, which to me is amazing in itself, because you can imagine a city with more streets packed in, it's going to be more dense, like more traffic, which creates more heat on a computer. Yet these chips, like these phones, don't have a fan in them, and the iPads don't have a fan in them, and the M1 MacBook Air, M2 MacBook Air, M3, like these don't have fans in them, yet they're making the chips tighter and tighter. They're making these chips more efficient by making them have less and less distance between their transistors and everything with no fan. That's amazing to me. I mean, that's, you know, that's astronomical.
That is, yeah. I mean, I have the M1, and I have a fan. It's the M1 Pro, but I still don't hear the fan too often. It's rare that I hear the fan.
Right, and so I'm amazed. Now, I have heard some reports. I know we're talking about the phone. I've heard some reports about the laptops, which we're going to get into in a little bit. But, I mean, to be honest, I'm not going to complain. Apple was the first to bring a 3-nanometer chip to the masses, and they did it through the iPhone instead of a computer. So most computers are not 3 nanometers. And I don't want to say there are no other phones that are there on no other devices with 3-nanometer, because I haven't fact checked that yet. But I think at the moment this was announced, there were no phones or computers with 3-nanometer processing yet. Hmm. So this was a major leap forward in technology, not just for Apple, but everybody. They always have a better camera. So that was kind of the next topic. Their optical zoom was 5 times, which is 120 millimeter focal length. A lot more people are using iPhones for videography and photography. And so this is a big deal for them. So the scary fast event, which we're going to talk about in a second, the entire thing was recorded on an iPhone 15 Pro Max, obviously with some extra help from professional gear behind it. But still,
yeah, that's impressive that they could say that.
Right. That's kind of a trophy for Apple to say we felt that confident with our phones that we could use it as the lens. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Well, there's some motion pictures that are using iPhones. So, I mean, it's kind of cool that, you know, that's already been happening even before Apple did it for one of their events. So,
yeah, it was like after the event was over and they kind of stuck that line on the screen that said this entire event was recorded on iPhone 15 Pro Max.
Yeah, I liked how people they did
the YouTubers were like, wait, I need to see how that was done. And so they released a video showing the process and the behind the scenes. I thought that was cool.
Yeah.
And the other thing, they added a customizable action button on the left side. Mm-hmm. And I think this was based off of research they did on the Apple Watch Ultra, which has an action button. So you can customize it to do whatever you want.
That's cool.
For me, I think, let me see what mine does. I think I just have it bringing up the camera. Yeah, that's what I do. But what I think is cool, and I just haven't spent time doing this, I've watched a few videos about it, is you can actually program that button to work with Siri shortcuts. And so with that, you can build all sorts of workflows off of that action button, which is what people were doing with the Apple Watch Ultra. I haven't played with it. I just set it to my camera and left it. I'll have to spend some time playing with it so I can talk about it more knowledgeable. But the last thing about this, the Pro series, is capturing spatial videos. And you can relive those on the upcoming Vision Pro. I really need to see this to understand how significant it is. But I know that all the YouTubers that have tried the spatial videos are like geeking out about it. So I don't know, other than Vision Pro, how you would be able to, like, I don't know if you record it on your iPhone. Can you actually, I guess it looks normal, but I guess when you put it on Vision Pro, it'll have
I was wondering. So how does it look on the phone when you record it on the phone?
I haven't tried it, so I don't know. I need to go into the settings, I guess, and attempt a recording. I don't think it's going to look any different. It's just flat, so there's no way to see it. I think it's one of those things. That's not enough reason to spend $3,500 for a headset, but
it's kind of like the equivalent of back in the old days with the SLR cameras, you know, shooting in RAW, and you could always know that if you're shooting in RAW, you could always like change the color schemes and everything, and you don't have any, you don't lose any of the quality. But yeah, until you're like a photographer doing that. And, you know, if you don't have the software to do it, then it doesn't really matter, you know. So until we have the Vision Pro, it's not really going to matter on that one. But, yeah, it'll be cool to see once they're out.
That's a good way to describe it. All the data is there, but you won't be able to see it unless you have a 3D headset of some kind, or a augmented reality headset or whatever. And so that's cool. I really need to do it, because I'm always recording family events, taking pictures, and now that I have a phone that can do it, I should just, you know, if it doesn't eat up my data, I need to record some videos.
Wonder what it looks like on the Meta 3.
I'm sure it'll look great if Apple allows it to work on it.
If they allow it.
I'm pretty sure that's not going to play on the Quest headset.
You don't think?
Oh, no. But anyway, that's pretty much the news for the iPhone 15 Pro and Pro Max. Obviously, there's smaller details, but those are the highlights. As far as the watches, they released Series 9, which has an S9 SIP, and that's what they're calling their processor, SIP. I think it's System in a Package, something like that. If I'm wrong, I'll double check later. But, you know, just the next generation of their Apple Watch chip. Apparently, the S9 has, you know, the code and the algorithms that allow you to do the double tap feature, which they also use on the Vision Pro, but it's all visual based. But on the S9 chip, it just uses like your wrist motions and gyroscope and accelerometer to kind of detect that motion. And that would seem like a gimmick, but I've heard people talk about it and they say it's really cool. It's something that gets you kind of spoiled. I'm assuming if you use it, then you can't unsee it once you've seen it. If once you experience it, you don't want to go back to not having it. If you've seen it, you know what I'm saying. But basically, like if somebody calls and you have your watch on, it rings, you can just double tap to answer the call. Or if you want to take a photo and you have the watch as your viewfinder, you can double tap for that. There's a lot of other things that you can do with it, and so it's just a new gesture that allows you to have a greater experience.
Yeah, the ads kind of illustrate it pretty well. I like the ads that when they were talking about it. Have you missed, just speaking of the Apple Watch, how many times have you swiped down trying to find the controls? Like, you still do that?
Yes.
I found myself still doing it. Like, wait a minute. Oh, yeah, it's on the button now.
Right, because they announced the new Watch OS, and it's a revamped interface. and I'm still getting used to it. The watchOS interface is sort of a departure from the way Apple does things, and so I never really memorized all of it, like how to navigate the whole thing. I knew I needed the crown to get back to the home page, and like I knew how to turn it off, and then I know how to swipe down to get to my control center. And now I'm trying to relearn it again.
They added that because of Wozniak, because I heard Wozniak complain about how Apple wasn't using buttons, like actual physical buttons on their devices anymore, and they were doing it all in software. So I'm wondering if maybe they listened to him on that one, and that's why the button works.
Yeah, it's possible. Like, yeah, clicking the button on the side brings the control center. I got to remember that. Thank you.
I know. I keep forgetting, and I'm like, wait a minute. Oh, yeah, it's the button. I finally trained myself, but it took me a while.
Yeah, they always have new watch faces and other things they add to the watch OS. I'm never excited about the new updates. I'm just thankful. Like, I'll just update it and go, okay, good. I think if people get new exercise options, I think they're pretty happy with watchOS. And the new watch is a little bit brighter than before, up to 2,000 nits, which I'm not exactly sure what the last version was, but they're definitely saying this is the brightest screen they've ever installed on an Apple Watch. And then an Apple Watch Ultra 2, minor spec bump from the original one. I think all of these phones have on-device Siri processing. I don't think that's unique to the Apple Watch Ultra 2. And that means it's going to be a lot faster for you to call that assistant up and make requests because everything's done on device. So, you know, that's pretty much what wraps up the September Wonderless event, which is primarily phones and watches. And I think I'm going to jump to Scary Fast, which was right. I think it was October 30th, right? It was right before Halloween. So they were kind of playing on the scary with that intro. It was kind of a haunted theme with the music and the nighttime and the fog. They were trying to
it was clever
play on that. Yeah, it was pretty clever marketing. And, you know, the way they created the intro was like, okay, now I know why they call it Scary Fast. I thought it was strictly just the new chips that were coming out for the laptop. And I'm like, oh, I see what you did, Apple. The big news really was the MacBook Pro. And we didn't know what other devices would get the new chips. But same thing, 3-nanometer chips were brought over to the MacBook Pro. And here's what's weird about this. I don't know if you knew this. I didn't realize until after the event. The M2 came out the same year. Or
close to it.
Was it January?
Yeah, it was like, no, I think it was like February when the M2 came out, right?
Right. I think the MacBook Pro actually got...
Yeah.
I'd have to go back and check this again.
I think you're right.
But I think what happened, Apple said, there's no way we can put a 3-nanometer chip in our iPhone and not bring it to the MacBook Pro before other, you know, competitors start bringing 3-nanometer chips out. So I forgot because I have M1 Max. I'm like, I don't need an M2 Max. I don't really care about that. I'm like, I need to be reasonable. Can't keep spending money. And like my laptop, I haven't maxed out at all. Pun intended, no pun intended, however you want to look at it. And so I just ignored the M2s. And then when they announced M3, I was like, okay, I know why Apple's doing this. It's because they want to be the first to say their MacBook Pro had a 3-nanometer processor. But yeah, 14 and 16 inch Pros, and there's a new option for a space black color. I'll read through these specs. There's lots of specs online. You can configure them however you want. But the base M3 is 8-core CPU, 10-core GPU, and 8 gigs of memory. The M3 Pro, like the mid-tier model, starts at 11-core CPU, 14-core GPU, 18 gigs of unified memory. And then finally, the M3 Max base model of that configuration is 14-core GPU, 30-core GPU, 36 gigs of unified memory out of the box. And you can go up from there and spend as much money as you want.
I was going to say, Swift App School is going to buy us one, right? M3 Max, I think, right?
To be announced.
M1's getting kind of slow, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting because Apple has a little bit of what I call the Samsung problem, which is you bring such a great device out that the next version, people are like, I don't know why I need that.
Yeah.
And then you bring a third one out and people are like, it's like, I don't know why I need the third one either. This happened to Samsung years ago.
Yeah. That's how I kind of feel about my M1. I mean, my M1's still fast, and I don't really need anything faster right now, you know?
Yeah, and if you're running, like, Clean My Mac, not a sponsor.
Yeah.
You can see how much CPU utilization and RAM and space you're using at all times. Yeah. And so I'm like, I'm not even taxing my machine. I'm fine. Stop getting anxious to buy another Mac because the specs came out and you're excited, Charles Long. Like, yeah. Like, pay off the machine you got.
That's right.
Oh, so it's funny because sometimes I'm like, oh, I could just get an M3 Max and, oh, and then do what? Like, I'm not trying to impress anybody. I just want a machine that doesn't feel like it lags when I'm trying to do something that takes a little extra power. I've got that.
It helps when I listen to other developers who are much bigger than I am, and they still have the older machines. So then I go, okay, great. I'm not alone.
Yeah. A lot of people that are YouTubers are saying, here's the machine. If you still have an Intel Mac, we highly recommend you upgrade. If you don't, like, some of them are sending their machines back. A couple of the prominent, you know, YouTubers said, I think MKBHD said he sent his back and he just kept his M1 Max. Really? He said, it does everything I need it to do on the road.
Yeah.
So why, you know, there's just no reason to upgrade.
Yeah.
So they're making these M series chips again. I feel like their efficiency is just out of this world. And I think they have to recognize they can keep making M4, M5, M6, whatever. And, you know, they're going to pull in more users that don't have the M series chips, but they can't expect us to upgrade every couple of years.
Yep.
Even. So the iMac also got updated. They had never received the M2 chip, so they got an upgrade to the M3. And it's 8-core CPU, 8-core GPU, 256 gigabytes storage, 8 gigs unified memory. And that's, you know, the base model. Mm-hmm. And the iMac is for the home basic machine for the family that wants to share a Mac or whatever, or have just a all-in-one solution around the office. That's what that's for. So it's not a gaming machine. However, gaming was talked about and they are getting more serious about it. Gaming is a very interesting topic on the Mac because it's sort of a chicken and egg problem where there's not a lot of games on the Mac platform yet. So people are like, eh, it's not a gaming machine. However, they're providing the tools and technology so that you can port your games from the PC now over from the Intel to the Mac. So you don't buy a Mac for gaming, but if you have one, you're getting more options than you used to. I think it's smart for Apple to make basically an emulator so that you can take your Intel-based games and easily port them over. That makes it a much easier transition. So not saying go buy a Mac for gaming, but if you have a Mac, you get one of these newer M series Macs, especially with the M3 chips and running macOS Sonoma, the latest version, there's a game mode. And essentially what it's doing is emulating the Intel processor architecture. So you can play those games right on the Mac without having to do a lot of translation. It's pretty cool. And that's going to allow Apple to kind of at least people to have confidence in the hardware. I think that's the thing. Developers are like, I'm not spending time building on that. And you can't run my game at 60 frames per second. So now they can take their Intel game, port it over to the Mac very easily with this game mode and say, oh, it runs pretty good. So then that gives them more incentive to go ahead and make their game native for the Mac. That was the whole purpose of doing that. So I'm excited for that. Again, I don't really play that many games on my Mac, if any, but it's nice to see that they're putting in some attention there to show that they are making a lot of progress with their chips. So that's cool.
And speaking of cool, Apple really surprised everybody in mid-November. They said in 2024 that they've announced they're going to adopt the rich communication service messaging standard for all iPhones. Nobody was really expecting that. So the RCS is starting sometime in 2024 as part of the software update that they'll have. And yeah, it gives Android users kind of the same, they'll be treated kind of the same way, I guess, in the future. You won't see any like green bubbles versus blue bubbles and all that.
I'm wondering. I'm still interested in seeing what is Apple going to do about this. What this technically means is, you know, I was reading up on the history behind messaging, and I know that what we call SMS, which is your basic text messaging, was, you know, it worked, but there was more opportunities for messaging to improve. And I think Steve Jobs was one of the people who challenged the carriers, hey, let's make a unified messaging platform. My understanding is they didn't want to. They wanted to keep that control because they made money on text messaging. And a lot more services were coming on where you didn't need it. And so eventually they had to stop charging for text messaging, because essentially text messaging is a fancy way of doing mass communication, but email is free, you know. So iMessage came out as it was originally called, and it allowed for you to do more than you could do with text messaging, primarily like large photos and videos and that sort of thing. But obviously Android was still running SMS. And so eventually they kind of adopted the same mindset. Let's just make a standard that works for all the Android platforms, which was RCS, rich communication. So basically it allows for the like next version of MMS, which, you know, the first version of text messages was SMS, and then it was MMS for multimedia, but they took it to the next level with Android and came up with this RCS platform. Of course, Apple and Google aren't going to be on the same page about how this should move forward, and they haven't been on the same page about how to make this a unified platform.
Yeah, so it's still to be determined how that's going to look. You know, what I think they ought to do is just get rid of the like color schemes and just have like Apple logo, Samsung logo, Android logo, and you can turn it on and off. Like if you want it on there, you could. If you want to show off that you have an iPhone, you can put it on there.
My opinion, I guess, is Android's going to have this particular feature that doesn't work on iOS, and iOS is going to have features that are not going to work on Android. But I am so tired of the multi-threads. And I hope this solves it. That's the only thing I really care about in this conversation is like, if I'm communicating with my family, not everybody has iPhones, not everybody has Facebook Messenger, not everybody has WhatsApp, not everybody uses the same messaging platforms. So if we're just going to text, can we get rid of, I don't care about blue and green. I just want, so when I text my family with more than 20 people in it, that I don't get a reply back on a different thread.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that, but if you have more than 20 people, I don't know if that's a message issue, RCS issue, or because it's mixed environments and it's a limitation. Like, if we could just solve that, I would be happy. I don't get into the blue versus green.
I mean, now that Apple has different price points, I mean, I don't think you can use that argument anymore. Maybe back when iPhones were the most expensive phone out there, and that's like all you could get, but now you can get a pretty cheap iPhone, you know, cheaper than some Androids. So I don't know if you could really make that case that
wherever you find those, please let me know.
No, you can. You can find, I mean, they've got the, that's what I'm, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, you can have an iPod Touch. You don't have to necessarily have an iPhone.
Those still exist? I didn't know
they still have them. They're cheap.
Apple never talks about them. Yes. Yeah, I think for me, it's just, I think this the teenage audience, we talked about this in a podcast before, the teenage audience,
they get
into this like, you have iPhones, there's a status with that, and that makes me feel left out because I have a green bubble. You know, I guess I should stop questioning the teenage mind. I was there once, I understand, but it's just a different, you know, different situation. Mm-hmm. Once you become an adult, some things don't matter anymore, or shouldn't anyway. But yeah, I'm interested in seeing what does this mean going forward, that Apple's going to allow RCS to work. And I know it's been pressure from Android, and this also has been pressure from the EU.
Yeah.
EU's talking about, I wonder if Apple's going to adopt it. And sure enough, I just thought Apple was going to put messages on Android before they would adopt RCS. Mm-hmm. So that's a little surprising to me.
Yeah.
Like, they have Apple Music on, don't they have Apple Music on Android?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, you know, I thought that's what tactic they were going to take, is say, okay, messages now works on Android just like Apple Music.
They have FaceTime too.
Well, sort of.
Or they advertise that they have it.
People on Android phones can't make a FaceTime. They can't initiate.
Oh, they can't initiate. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. It works pretty good. I like it. My mom and family have Android devices, so we've used it before.
On part two for Something Cool, we're going to put a link to the new ad that came out that advertises the personal voice and live speech feature that Apple's released. Yeah, it's a great example of Apple storytelling. You'll just have to watch the ad. I don't want to really give it away, but it's a great ad. And at the end, you kind of like get to see, wow. it really
right.
It shows and doesn't tell, as the best ads do. So it's a good one.
I'm not going to spoil it either. But when I first saw the ad, I was like, what is this?
Yeah.
Like, what is Apple doing? I don't understand this new ad. It didn't make sense. And at the end, I was like, oh, I see, Apple.
Yeah.
Really good. I love it. Yeah, I love what they did.
You have to watch the entire ad.
Yeah, I loved it. I was like, that was pretty good. I like that. It showcases why Apple's so brilliant with their marketing. It's not like marketing to try to be manipulative. It is, here's what you can do with technology.
Yeah.
I think all companies should adopt this rather than, you know, talk about the gigabytes and the, you know, they can tout the nanometer stuff, but they don't spend all their time talking about specs. They typically showcase experiences. That's what Apple does.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason why people get upset at Apple sometimes, because they're like, oh, we could do that a long time ago with Android. It's like, mm-hmm. that's a feature, but they're not showing you how to utilize it. Samsung, I think, does a pretty good job of showing some experiences, but this is all Apple does.
Mm.
They might advertise a feature, you know, something's been out 10 years on other platforms, but on the iPhone, it's new. And because of their ad power and their marketing, people get excited about the commercial that comes out and showcases how to use it. And
yeah.
they're like, oh, and everybody else is like, oh, we've had that a long time ago. But yeah, but nobody knew about it.
And then part three of this Something Cool I just came up with on the fly. It was released mid-November. You probably heard about it. The AI pen from Humane. Which
oh, yeah, I heard about that.
There are several former Apple employees. I know Ken Kishinza is one of them who's been working on this. And it looks like something out of Star Trek. I mean, it's like it's a little pin that you wear on your shirt. And, yeah, the examples that they show is like somebody's talking in a different language and then it just starts saying what they said for them. So if somebody's speaking English, the other person's speaking Spanish, and it's on the, like, instantly interpreting what they're saying and saying it back in Spanish. So it's, I don't know, it's kind of crazy. And then the other thing it does is it has it's got a projection of whatever's on the pen is like projecting onto your hand, and you can interact with it. So it's using gestures as well, but there's no apps. So it's kind of interesting to see, like, I wonder if this is going to take off or what. It's $6.99, though, so it's not cheap.
I'm like,
you know,
I'm not sure. That's like, I feel like they, with a product like this, you have to take a loss.
Yeah.
And I know that because the problem with this device is it should complement, but it's going to compete against your phone.
It is, yeah.
Like, I saw that and I thought, how can we utilize this and replace the phone? Well, if you can't, then you got to buy a $600 accessory.
yeah.
And the only thing I know that works that way is the Apple Watch. And the reason why is because it has sort of a niche in that it can be used for health and other reasons.
Yeah.
And I guess they're trying to do the same thing in that they're saying you don't have to have your phone with you. You can just use this.
Yeah, you can make calls on it too. I know. And it has, I think they're using, I've forgotten which, they're not using Verizon, but it's something, I think it's
T-Mobile.
T-Mobile, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're using T-Mobile.
Okay, yeah. It's a cool idea. I just feel like if you really want to kind of break into the industry.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess they obviously have done their homework.
They've definitely got a lot of funding behind them, but yeah, I don't know. It's interesting that they're doing gestures too. So it's kind of like they knew what Apple was doing with the Vision Pro with their gestures, and now they're doing something different. So I don't know.
Hey, we're in a world where if you got an idea, just try it.
Yeah.
Stick over $500 on it and see if it's going to work. I don't know. I can't say it won't work, but very interesting idea. I think the future is going to be very interesting with all these headsets getting less expensive. I still feel like AR glasses is the future.
Well, I know that, what was it, Bill Gates said that definitely the future is not going to be in apps. Apps are going to go away. And then it's just going to be like wearable. Whatever you're wearing is going to be, like, the software is just going to be part of us now. It'll be interesting to see how it is. I don't know if that's in the next 5 years or the next 20 years.
I know, it's moving so rapidly, and I'm not going to talk about AI today because that's a whole other podcast episode. But at the pace it's innovating right now with the competition, who knows?
Who knows?
I'm excited and fearful at the same time. Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Swift App School podcast.
You can always find us online at swiftappschool.com, and we're also on social media at Swift App School on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Facebook. Bye, y'all.
Goodbye.